This hour, we are celebrating the 50th birthday of Motown Records. Hard to believe it was 50 years ago Motown started. This hour of the program, Dennis Coffey is joining us. Dennis was there at the beginning of Motown. He is the author of Guitars, Bars, and Motown Superstars. You heard him play in what we just played for you right now because he was an honorary member of Motown's elite rhythm section, the Funk Brothers. He was one of Detroit's most in-demand session guitarists during the 60s and 70s, made his debut at Motown, forging the unmistakable intro to what you just heard, the Temptations classic Cloud Nine. He became a regular at Hitsville, USA, played on chart toppers for Marvin Gaye, The Supremes, Stevie Wonder, Gladys Knight, and Junior Walker. His whole involvement in the music scene is quite a story, and at some point he had to leave the music scene because it just wasn't doing very well, so he worked in the auto lines in Detroit, and he has subsequently been on PBS with reminiscences of Motown, and we're going to talk about all of that this hour of the program. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and if you'd like to send an email, it's talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. We're interested in finding out what your favorite Motown songs are, too, and we're going to play many of them this hour, so get those dancing shoes on. Dennis, thank you very much for being with us. Hello.
Hello, Kathleen. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing good.
Are you feeling old? 50 years!
Well, I'm still out cranking it, man. I got young guys in my band, and we're still packing places and still jamming. I'm starting a new CD. Started it Wednesday in the studio, so I'm still out here doing it.
Good for you. Good for you. And it's something you knew you always wanted to do from the time that you were a kid, right? Can you tell us the beginning story of how you had your rock and roll band and how you broke into the business?
You know what? I was just actually quite young, and I had a couple cousins in Marilyn and Jim Thompson in the UP of Michigan, and they played guitars and sang country and western. And when I saw that, they were kind enough to show me some guitar chords because my family's from the Copper Country up there, so we used to go up every summer for a couple of weeks. So that kind of intrigued me, and then once I got the hang of things and started practicing and learning songs off the radio, I did my first record date at 15, and I was contracted the other players, and I had to make sure one of them had a driver's license so we could get to the session.
You cut a record in 1955, and
yes.
You say that you couldn't have imagined more than 30 years later people would still remember that record, and they have.
Yeah, and I still get calls for sessions and so forth here in Detroit, and still playing and doing concerts, and it was interesting because a year and a half ago, I got to play with the legendary Les Paul.
Thing.
And they had Richie Sambor and Slash was there and Billy Gibbons and all the guitar slingers. And that was the only time I wasn't the oldest guy in the band.
I didn't know you had played with Les Paul. Talk about his influence, because when he died, people, just all kinds of musicians, came forward and said what a huge influence he was on their music.
Well, he was, I think someone that he kind of idolized was the great Django Reinhardt, you know, back in the day. And I've listened to all Django's stuff and a lot of Les Paul and Mary Ford stuff. And then also, being a record producer, I can appreciate his multi-track recording techniques that he invented. And when I played with him, I spoke to him briefly in Cleveland, and there was a guitarist in Detroit called Wayne Wright. And he was the guy that actually, Les told me, convinced him to get back in the club scene again in New York. And when I lived in New York for a few years in the early 80s, I was supposed to go with Wainwright to Les Paul's house. And then we had to change it. I think he was ill that day or something. So Jim Felber, the guy at Gibson who handles artist relations, kind of hooked me up with this thing. And then because I had used Gibson in my entire career, especially the Gibson Firebird and all the Motown sessions, and they gave me a new, brand new 355 Gibson last year, so that was kind of nice.
That's pretty nice. We just played the intro, your intro to Cloud Nine, The Temptations, Cloud Nine. That really got you rolling. It got you noticed. What is special about that? What were you doing?
Okay, what happened was is I was James Jamerson, the bass player with the Funk Brothers. He called me up one day and introduced me to Hank Cosby, who was the Stevie Wonder's producer, and he was a contractor at Motown. And Hank said that they were starting a producer's workshop upstairs at Golden World to give the producers a chance to experiment without incurring all these studio time expenses. And so one of the producers that came to that workshop was Norman Whitfield, and he had a chart on this song called Cloud Nine. He says, well, I want to see if I can get some new ideas on this song for the Temptations. And so, well, he counted it off, and I just happened to have this pedal that is a wah-wah pedal that it causes the guitar to make the sound like a wah-wah sound. And I pulled that pedal out and put that on the introduction, and Norman looked at me. He says, that's it. That's what I've been looking for. And within 2 weeks, I was at Motown doing the actual tracks for the Temptations, and Norman had me from then on all his stuff, you know, with Gladys and all the Temptations songs and everything else. And then it became, what else do you have out of that bag, you know? Mm-hmm. So I had the wah-wah pedal, then I had a guitar distortion device, and then I had an Echoplex that was a tape echo device, and then he just he wanted to see all the stuff, so we were off and running.
Hmm. You mentioned Stevie Wonder. Let's play a little bit of Stevie Wonder, because you have some remarkable things to say about working with him. Stevie Wonder, our guest is Dennis Coffey, author of Guitars, Bars, and Motown Superstars, and he worked with all of the greats with Motown. He was one of the Motown greats himself. So that's Stevie Wonder early on with one of his hit songs, I Was Made to Love Her. Dennis, you write that Stevie had an ear for music like no other producer I've ever worked for. Nothing got by him. He could be difficult, so I want to talk about his ear and how he was difficult.
You know, he was not difficult as a person. What it was is he was difficult for someone like myself who's creative, because Stevie would, when I was doing overdubs for Stevie, he would he'd sing a guitar lick, and then he wanted you to play that lick on his record, and he wanted it so precise and so exact, because it wasn't written, that it was very hard to get into his head, and he made you do it until it was perfect to what he heard. And I found that, because Norman always let me do my thing. You know, Stevie was so particular. When we did It's a Shame with the Spinners, Stevie was producing that, and we were in the studio, and Stevie went to Pistol Allen and Uriel Jones, the two drummers on the session, and he kept singing them. He wanted them to play this drum fill. And they actually tried it, and they got frustrated just like I did, because Stevie's such a genius. And they said, Stevie, you're just going to have to play the drums. We don't hear what you're singing. So Stevie played the drums
on
that session.
That's great. He has been a hit performer, a hit machine, really, for a long, long time, hasn't he, Stevie Wonder?
Yes. The last time I saw Stevie perform was here in Detroit at the 50th Motown anniversary. I go to all the events as a Motown alumni, and I also talk to tour groups at the museum. And the show started off with the Temptations. And then Aretha Franklin came up and sang a birthday song to Berry Gordy. So that was wild. And then Stevie came up and did a couple songs. And what was amazing is he made the audience sing the verses while he shut up. And the audience sang the verses word for word, note for note, perfect. And then he sang the choruses. And then halfway through his set, Kid Rock got up. And the two of them are doing duets, man. So it was wild.
Oh, it must have been wild. Is that on tape somewhere?
I don't think so. But it was an amazing thing. And the last time that I spoke with Stevie, sadly, it was at Pistol Allen's funeral, one of the Motown legendary drummers. And I spoke with Stevie. He says, yeah, man. He says, I was just listening to Scorpio last week, and he hummed the melody perfectly to me.
Oh, isn't that something?
Nice man.
Yeah,
nice
man. Get it on tape. We'd love to see that. That would be a big seller, I would think. Tell me about the pattern for the songs, the chorus, the what do you call it, the A, B, C, D thing that was going on in Motown?
What you usually have in most songs is you probably have an introduction, and then you probably have a verse, which is they'll call maybe letter A. Maybe if you repeat it, maybe A and B. And then you'll usually have a chorus, which could be C, like a refrain, and you might have some sort of bridge. And then at the end of the song, you'll have the ending or a fade. That's usually how the songs are structured. What we would do at Motown is what my day would be like is I would get at the studio, say, 11, sometimes even 10, and the Funk Brothers, we'd walk into the studio, we'd sit down, and there'd be a music in front of us, sheet music. Usually on the session, there'd be the producer and the arranger. The producer had the vision of what he was trying to get to, and the arranger had the notes and the roadmap of how to get there. And what we were expected to do is we were expected to record a hit song every hour, one, reading the chart correctly, two, adding extra riffs and feel to it to really, that's where the first step of the song materializing was the foundation laid by the Funk Brothers. And we would do one song an hour for a three-hour session. We'd get three songs done. We'd take an hour off for lunch, you know, go down the street to Howard Johnson's, and we'd come back and do another three-hour session and get three more songs. And then what I would do is I'd have some dinner, and then I'd run over to the producer's workshop that Motown had at 7 at Golden World, and I'd be there for 2.5 hours. And then I had just enough time to head over to Holland Dozier and Holland's studio, Tower Studios, at 10 to do a three-hour session for HDH for their Invictus and Hot Wax labels. So that's kind of how my day was going.
You had to absolutely love what you were doing.
It was fun, and when I wasn't doing that, I was doing production with Mike Theodore, and I was playing with a jazz trio with Lyman Woodard and Melvin Davis at a jazz club.
Hmm. It was important to you. Some of the book talks about how you were called sometimes at the very last minute to do a session, and your ability to read music quite accurately, to do sight reading, was important in your career.
It became more important when I got out to L.A., but my undergrad studies, I was a harmony and theory major at Wayne State University, and then I eventually ended up getting a general studies degree and then a master's degree in instructional technology from Wayne.
Mm-hmm.
But Wayne taught me how to write, how to orchestrate, and how things fit together so that if I can hear a song or a guitar lick or a bass lick, I can put it on paper. And then that way, Mike Theodore and I used to arrange for like 21 pieces. We'd have strings and horns and all kinds of stuff. So that was pretty invaluable at that point. And then when I was living in L.A., most of that stuff was sight reading. And I prefer to, and when I play a gig, I memorize the songs because I want to find that extra level of creativity and close my eyes and get to that other place. And sometimes I felt the sight reading got in the way of that sometimes.
Do you think when you listen to music, because of what you just described, you're hearing it in a very different way than most of us are?
What I end up doing, sometimes, you know, music takes you back. It's like the soundtrack of your life, to quote Dick Clark, you know. So it might take you back to different periods in your life, you know, when you hear music that you remember from those periods. But with me, a lot of times, I played on so many records that I would start thinking about it, bring me memories instead of what I was doing. It would bring memories back of recording that song.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Dennis. We're celebrating Motown's 50th birthday this hour of the program. Dennis is the author of Guitars, Bars, and Motown Superstars, and he was in Motown's elite rhythm section, the Funk Brothers, for a number of years. Your calls in just a moment. Also, your emails are very welcome.
I say to myself, you're such a lucky guy. To have a girl like her is truly a dream come true.
Supremes and Come See About Me, Motown's 50th birthday this year. Dennis Coffey is our guest. His book is Guitars, Bars, and Motown Superstars. And he was in the early days of Motown and the later days of Motown as well, playing music, being one of the most in-demand session guitarists during the 60s and 70s. Before we go to some calls and to some emails, Dennis, tell me about the Supremes. There's been some controversy about that group. Were they easy to work with?
A lot of people don't understand that when we worked at Motown and when I worked at Golden World Studios before that, the artists were very rarely there. You know, what we laid down is we laid down the rhythm tracks, which meant usually two drummers, bass player, then you had three guitar players, then you'd have vibes. And you'd have two keyboard players and tambourine and congas usually. That was the basic rhythm section. We laid down the rhythm tracks. We didn't even know what the vocals were going to be doing. So we never worked with the artist. The only time that I encountered Diana Ross was with Berry Gordy. Twice she came in the studio. She was doing some production. The first time I was doing some crazy guitar, loud feedback in the overdub room, and I looked up and saw Barry and Diana looking in the room, probably wondering what craziness was going on there. And then I saw her out in L.A. with Barry. They were doing a session, and she just seemed very nice, you know. But as far as the contact generally, except when I did the in-concert thing with the Temptations out in L.A., they sent me a nice thank you letter. And then I had to do Michael Jackson and the Jackson 5 out in L.A. in their live show. And apparently the guitar player left during the rehearsal, so there was no rehearsal time, so I had to play the whole show cold. And
wow.
Motown wanted me to do it, so I ended up doing it. That was pretty challenging.
Woo, the pressure is on. Let's go to the phone calls. Paul is our first caller from Duluth. Hi, Paul.
Boy, I'm so glad that I'm amazed I got to be the first. I just want to tell your guest, I not only went to Wayne State University, but I grew up in Detroit during the 50s and 60s. And you and the other geniuses at Motown formed the musical backdrop of my life. And I remember lazy days in the summer listening to the radio, and just the music was just mind-blowing to me at the time. And I wasn't going to go on, but I want to ask one question. There was a song called We'll Sing in the Sunshine.
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
Yeah, and I've forgotten who did it, but it was like the anthem of a whole summer for me. And I wonder if you could talk a little, if you know anything about it or who did it or...
Boy, we were doing so many records over there that I tried to put a discography in my book, what I could still remember, but it's been such a long time ago that I'm not sure. It almost sounds like a Supremes, Diana Ross maybe kind of song.
Somebody will let us know, I'm sure. I remember the word, the We'll Sing in the Sunshine, We'll Laugh Every Day.
Yeah, I think it was also a pop song that was out by somebody else. But Motown sometimes covered those songs on their albums, too.
Uh-huh. Thank you so much for your call. Let's go to another caller. Bill is calling from Windsor. Hey, Bill.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi. What,
great show. The question I have is I love Marvin Gaye and you know, pretty much all the Motown music. First question is, did you play with Marvin Gaye at all?
I did one overdub on one of his records here on the master that Norman Whitfield had me do, but I did the I Want You, the entire CD with Marvin out in L.A., and Marvin was in the studio with us, very laid back, very nice cat, man, and he was in for the whole process. He was walking around. I can see it in my mind. You know, he'd come over to me, and I'm playing guitar on this track, and he'd, you know, say, well, you know, can we do this or a little bit of that? And he was kind of, you know, giving us some feedback on what his vision was for that particular CD.
Yeah, he was quite he was quite creative as well.
Oh, yeah.
The question I have, though, is vaguely remember he was shot by his father, who was a minister.
Yeah.
Is there more to the story? I'm just curious.
You know what? All I knew was whatever was in the papers. I never got any inside track on that. I'm not sure of any of the details of much of that at all, other than how tragic it was.
Marvin Gaye, and I heard it through the grapevine. I found it interesting, Dennis, that you used the phrase, he was a good cat, to describe him. Do you still talk about musicians using that word?
Yeah.
He's a good cat.
Yeah, we do. We would always refer to ourselves as the cats. We didn't really necessarily talk about ourselves as Funk Brothers. You know, we were always one of the cats.
Tell me about the first time that you met Berry Gordy. You were only, I think, 16 years old.
I was doing I had a partner called Durwood Hutto, who was a country, kind of a rockabilly singer. And he and I got together. He played acoustic guitar and I played electric. And we had written this song called Crazy Little Satellite. And we did a demo at Fortune Records. And Deborah Brown, who owned Fortune Records, we paid to do this demo so we could have a recollection of what we were doing, the song that we wrote. She was so impressed with it that she hooked us up with producer Nat Tarnopol, who was Jackie Wilson's manager. And Nat says, I want to record that. So he signed us to a contract. And I think we were about 16 years old, and we went to United Sound. Before we went to the studio, we went over to Berry Gordy was the arranger. This was before Motown. And we went over to Berry's house. I think it was on Brush, in Detroit, and it was a nice house, and Berry put together some musicians to rehearse with us in his living room, and that's the first time I met Berry, and I had spoken with Berry at the reunion last year, just briefly, to tell him, that he was the only one that really had the vision and appreciated the music in Detroit to make something out of it. And he said he could have not, in his estimation, could not have created Motown in any other city but Detroit.
Why?
So that was when I met him.
Why was it Detroit was the city for Motown and no place else?
I think it's just because of the environment. It's a urban, gritty town, and there's music going on all over right now. I mean, you can go any place in Detroit any night of the week and hear live jazz. You can hear live R&B. You can hear live pop, live folk. Detroit's taken a lot of hits, but the music still survives, and I still play once a week at Northern Lights Lounge, and then I play Baker's Keyboard Lounge once a month when I'm in town and things. It's just always been a very musical city.
Right. Let's go to another call. Jay is next from Waupaca. Hi, Jay.
Hi.
Hi.
Say, it was Gail Garnett that made popular that song, We'll Sing in the Sunshine.
Okay, I knew.
Thank you.
Yeah, played it all summer.
Yeah, I knew it was a pop song, and I figured, I didn't know if Motown had covered it or not.
And let's talk a little bit more. You think about that. It was a perfect song for you. You're here for the summer, and then you'll be on your way. The soundtrack of your life, that quote that you use, and you mentioned it on the show from Dick Clark, is that the reason that we just, man, we hear these songs, Dennis, and you start dancing, and you think about your life, and music has a profound way of doing that to us, to marking the years, marking the phases of our lives.
I think music is really makes us human. I mean, it's an emotional music is created, you know, by artistic people, and it's an emotional response. It's a communication. Also, you know, when I create music, I go in my basement and get out my acoustic guitar, and these songs just start showing up. You know, so that is kind of like, I think it's just part of what defines us, you know, artistically, and defines us, our humanity. Music connects us, especially, again, when it's, I look at it from just different perspectives. I mean, people dance to it, they listen to it, you know, that kind of thing. That's what I've always felt, and I've, my mom told me when I was like 2 or 3 years old, I could name every song on the radio when I heard it played.
Did you really?
Yeah, I don't remember
really
that,
great.
But that's what she said.
Here's an email that's come in from John. Did you do the intro to My Girl?
No, I think that was Robert White. What the intro that I did was closest to that is the guitar figure on Just My Imagination. That was me, a figure that I created, and then Eddie Willis, another guitar player, is doing a little answering thing to it.
We go to more phone calls, and let's go to Greg from Racine. Hi, Greg.
Hi there. I fell in love with the Supremes because of a TV special called TCB that featured the Supremes and the Temptations. And I was just a little skinny white kid from Iowa, but I fell in love with the Supremes and ran out and bought their I Hear a Symphony LP and so on. But I have to say, with all due respect to your guest, who I know really worked a lot with the Temptations, I never cared for the Temptations nearly so much. And actually, none of the guy groups from Motown impressed me as much. I think mostly because I always felt like the harmonies of the guys never sounded all that carefully crafted. I mean, a lot of times, especially, of course, you had five Temptations, and you're almost always going to have kind of doubling up. I mean, there's not enough to go around in terms of just standard chord when you have five guys singing. But I always felt like it just sounded like those harmonies had not been as carefully worked out as I would have liked.
Right.
I wonder if your guest has a comment about that.
Dennis.
The big unknown secret is there was a vocal group called the Andantes at Motown. And they sang background on all that stuff. They added their voices to especially the girls' groups. So you would hear the girls' groups, but in the background were the Andantes, which were killer harmonizers. These gals could sing all that stuff, and they did. They were kind of the unsung heroes like the Funk Brothers. The Andantes were the unsung female vocal group that sung tight harmonies behind a lot of the girl vocal groups and even some of the guys mixed in.
Dennis Coffey is our guest. He's author of Guitars, Bars, and Motown Superstars. He also leads tours at the Motown Museum in Detroit. And speaking of the Supremes, this is one of my favorites, too. Dennis Coffey is our guest this hour, and we're talking about Motown. I want to talk a little bit about what was happening racially with Motown. Here you are, a guitarist. You're playing in integrated studios. The groups are primarily African-American that you're working with, and the country takes on to this. It's a big moment, it seems to me, in race relations. You have a lot of white kids who are dancing to black music.
The composition when I was there was mostly African American, and myself and Joe Messina and Jack Brokenshaw were the three Caucasian members. But I had been doing sessions, R&B and pop and everything else, all over the place with all the bands and everything too. And the city of Detroit, it wasn't so much about race. It was if you could play or you couldn't. That was the whole deal. It didn't matter what race you were. You had mixed bands playing all over the city, and you still do. It's just a matter of can you play or not, because you can't be in a band because of your race. It's all about the playing, and I had a great time at Motown. I mean, this is it was the best rhythm section in the world, you know. And it
yes.
There was never any racial overtones that I ever saw there. I mean, it was just like a family.
Right.
It was just great.
Yeah, isn't that wonderful? Isn't it? Did you ever think about your life in terms of, oh, I am just so lucky to have been born in this time and to be able to do this? You were born during the time of Motown, and you got to do guitar and make records because it was alive when you were alive.
I just think I'm very appreciative of all the breaks that I got. All I did was, again, when I was a teenager, especially during summer vacation, I used to practice guitar 8 hours a day, every day. So I was ready when the chance came, but that's why I thank Berry Gordy last year. I says, man, you were the only guy that really could pull it off in Detroit to create this international recording trademark that is so well known worldwide for such a long time in the city through your vision. I mean, that's what I told him last year.
Yeah. We're going to welcome more phone calls, and there are some lines open. We're celebrating Motown's 50th birthday this hour of the show with Dennis Coffey. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And Rick from, Nick it is, from River Falls is next. Hi, Nick.
Hi, Kathleen. Great show. Dennis, I've been a huge fan for many years. I love the tone of your guitar. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about working with Norman Whitfield and the shift from the more traditional pop sounds of Motown to the psychedelic soul, with groups like The Undisputed Truth and The Temptations. And also, I'd like to hear your opinions on being sampled and the use of your music in hip-hop. You know, Scorpio is a huge instrumental piece important to the whole movement. So that would be great. I love it.
Okay. Norman Whitfield was a very dynamic producer, writer, and he also was like the master of dynamics and breakdowns. A lot of times producers will be in the control room with the engineer and the arranger will be conducting the session. Norman would always be out there right in front of the drummers, and he would count off the songs, and he'd be in there just, I remember in the hot summer, we'd all be sweating in there, cranking out the funk, and Norman would be in there counting them off, and then he'd do these breakdowns. You know, he'd say, breakdown here, well, you're out and you're out. I'll cue you back in. So he was always taking these songs when he started making the extended length songs, where he'd be breaking them down to just a couple instruments, and then he'd cue the other instruments where to come back in. But he was like almost a part of the rhythm section. I mean, he was right out there with us counting and conducting, and just, you know, we were all in the vibe together with Norman. He was a master at dynamics.
Mm. We're going to play a little bit of Jackson 5 going into the break, and I know that you've played with them. I'm interested in hearing more about your reflections of that group, of the incredible worldwide love for Michael Jackson. Dennis?
Yes.
Yeah.
The first time I met Michael Jackson was here in Detroit at Hitsville, and he was like, he had to be like 6 or 7. I was in the studio, and we were recording some tracks that we thought would be for them, and they were down there, and his dad was looking at all the guitar effects pedals that I had, and I was explaining to him and his dad and the family what we were doing, And I had a friend of mine, Joe Podorsik, who owned Capitol Music. Also, he taught Ted Nugent how to play as far as a teacher goes. And so I sent the Jackson 5 over there to buy some effects and some gear from him because they wanted to do that. And I learned later the tracks that we had cut here because it was a young band. I guess Barry or somebody felt they were a little too funky, so they redid those things out in L.A.
Martha and the Vandellas, don't you love that name? Nowhere to Run. We're celebrating Motown's 50th birthday this hour with Dennis Coffey. Dennis has a book, Guitars, Bars, and Motown Superstars. He, of course, had the number one hit song, Scorpio. And if you go to our Facebook page, we do have Dennis playing Scorpio from a Soul Train appearance. And also, it has a link to his website, so be sure and go there during the course of, well, whatever you want to. It's going to be there for a long time. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. We go back to phone calls and to Janine from Milwaukee. Hi, Janine.
Hi there. Oh, this is so exciting. I want to thank Dennis Coffey for Scorpio. I'm glad you just brought that up because my question is, my brother and I were we were children of the 70s and really young, and that 45, man, we played that, we wore that out, you know, we had dance routines and everything, and I just want to know what it was like to record it and what you think about everything that's come out of that song, because it's such a, I mean, that's a desert island song, it's coming with me if I'm stranded, so.
Aww.
I love it. And I'm so excited to be able to thank him. That's just fantastic.
Well, thank you. I had a lot of fun making that record. I got this idea because I was writing a lot of horn and string arrangements and rhythm charts with Mike Theodore, my partner, that what would happen if I wrote horns, and instead of horns, I used guitars, a guitar band idea. On Scorpio, there's 9 guitars playing that melody, you know, through distortion, buzz tones. And what I did was I had the Funk Brothers minus James Jamerson, the bass player, and their guitar section, but the rest of the Funk Brothers are on Scorpio. And Bob Babbitt, who's also a Funk Brother, he played that fantastic bass solo on Scorpio, which was probably the best bass solo of all time, I think. So, we had a lot of fun. I remember sitting in the studio. We recorded it at the GM Studios here in Detroit, and I had the rhythm section, the Funk Brothers, there, and I had the arrangements out for them. And I was playing rhythm guitar, and we started running this song down, and then I put a breakdown in the middle of it. And during the breakdown, you can hear Bongo Eddie and Jack Ashford. Bongo was the conga player, and Jack Ashford was the tambourine player of the two Funk Brothers. You can hear them joking and laughing and making comments because they were having so much fun. And Babbitt's taking this solo, and Mike Theodore was at the control room. And he had one of the mics on, and that those voices were feeding through one of the microphones. And he said, well, just leave that in there. Let that in there. And that's how that thing happened. And I remember going to New York to do the first concert in Brooklyn or the Bronx, and we're in this hotel playing a live thing, and I looked up and we hit Scorpio, and there's 2,000 dancers in a conga line coming towards the bandstand. It was like, it was amazing, and of course we did get sampled and everything, and I do get paid for a lot of the samples now. Initially I did, but now I do.
And here is some of it right now. Dennis Coffey, our guest, his reflections on his years in Motown and beyond, guitars, bars, and Motown superstar, has been published in paperback. We're welcoming more phone calls. Thank you, Janine. That was just a wonderful call. We go next to Darcy from Oshkosh. Hi, Darcy.
Hi.
Hi.
My first time calling, but I'm a longtime listener. In fact, my daughter just moved to Pittsburgh, and she'll call me and say, Mom, who was on Kathleen Dunn today? She always wants to check in on her computer, so I give her advice on the shows. But I grew up in the Detroit area in the 60s, and it just, Motown just gets in your blood. And, you know, I'm in the car, and I'll hear a song, and I'll just start moving around. In middle school, we used to have a band, you know, music during the lunch hour, and boy, that's where I learned how to dance, because there was an awful lot of Motown, and listening to CKLW brings back a lot of memories hearing you talk, Dennis. So it kind of gets in your blood, and you just don't, it just never gets out. My kids laugh at me whenever a song comes on, or we're watching The Big Chill, and you see all
yes.
this music from,
yes.
from that era. It's
yeah.
really fun.
It so. Really is fun. Plus, it's darn good exercise, isn't it? I put on Motown when I'm doing the dishes or mopping the floor or just want to you know, dance around for a while. I'll bet a lot of people do that, Dennis.
Yeah, they probably do. I talk to people at the museum, and they come in there from all over the world. They had 150 people from the UK in there, and I knew a lot of those guys and gals because I had done a concert at Cleethorpes over there, and I did book signings in London and Normandy and Manchester. So they were coming up to me saying, oh, yeah, I remember you. I bought your book. I saw you at the bookstore. I saw you play the concert and everything. It was pretty wild.
The Funk Brothers, let's talk about them a little more because maybe you need to toot your horn more here, have played on more number one records than the Beatles, Elvis, the Rolling Stones, and the Beach Boys combined.
I also played with everybody else, you know, Ringo Starr, Barbra Streisand, Tom Jones, everybody on top of Motown, including the Hot Wax and Wilson Pickett and all the other artists, the Dramatics, Stax Records. Mm. So I had, on top of that, because I had played on a lot of different records. I remember one year straight when I was working at Motown in Holland, Dozier, Holland, that I was on 3 songs in Billboard Top 10 for a year straight and 10 songs in the Top 100 for a year straight. That's how many records were coming out. So there's a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, a lot of stuff going on. Let's go to another phone call. Rick is next from Stevens Point. Hi, Rick.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, it's an honor to talk to both of you. I just had a question, Dennis. My ears perked up when you mentioned the Firebird. I happen to have a custom shop Gibson Firebird, and perhaps you could talk a little bit about the one that you've mentioned and also what songs you use it on, and I'll hang up and listen to you. Thanks again.
I've got a Gibson Firebird that I bought used probably in 1964 or 1963 even, and I also bought a Gibson Birdland. At the same time, that Firebird I used on all the Motown sessions in Detroit. Then when I moved to L.A. and I lived out there for 3 years, I used it part of the time. And then I went to a Gibson 345 that I had converted to from stereo to mono. And I use the 345 right now on sessions. I've kind of retired the Firebird for a little bit. And I use my Gibson Birdland for the jazz gigs that I do. But all my guitars are Gibson, and I still have them.
Hmm. We're talking about Motown celebrating its 50th birthday, which officially it started in January 12 of 1960. Dennis played with many, many of the greats. He is author of Guitars, Bars, and Motown Superstars. And you'll remember his number one song, Scorpio. We have that on Facebook if you want to listen to the whole thing. And we'll take more of your phone calls in just one moment. 800-486-8655.
You become a young man now. Feel some things that you don't understand now. Before you ask some girl for a hand now, keep your freedom for as long as you can now. My mama told me, you better shop around. Oh yeah, you better shop around.
800-486-8655 is our number. Lest we leave everybody with the impression that life was all easy going, no problems, constant music recording, wonderful days, great gigs. There were some rough spots in all of this, too. The life of a musician is not always easy, is it, Dennis?
No, actually, I spent 25 years as a full-time musician playing with everybody, living in the New York area, living in L.A. and Detroit, and then it just came to a stop for whatever reason. The phone stopped ringing, so I still, you know, I had five children. So
five children.
Yeah, so I had to get busy. Some musicians stick with it, and in the end, you know, they suffer greatly for it. Myself, the writing was on the wall for me, so I had to reinvent myself. So I ended up going to work on the assembly line at General Motors, and I had 2 years of college then. And so I ended up getting my bachelor's degree, and then it ended up being in general studies. And then I ended up learning the training, you know, how to train, and getting a master's degree in instructional technology. So I was a certified trainer at GM, and then I shifted over, and I managed a robotics training center and did a lot of things like that. In the last 10 years, I was a lean manufacturing coach and assessor and trainer for Ford Motor Company, and they sent me to Germany twice, and I went down to Mexico and all their plants in North America. So I was like, every week I'd go Monday, and we'd get on the corporate jet and go to a plant, and I'd come back Friday. So instead of being a musician on the road, I was a Ford Motor Company consultant on the road.
Did you bring that guitar on the road, though?
No, I didn't do that. That would have. We were so busy out there. That's one thing I didn't do. But all the Ford people, once they pulled me up on the Internet and all that stuff, they all knew who I was. And so when I did the Four Tops had their 50th anniversary where they had Levi, they brought him out in a wheelchair, and he sang a couple verses with Aretha Franklin, and they had this whole show that was on ABC. Well, I played in that band. I was standing right behind him. So I heard yelling, and I looked up on the high tier there, and it was all the Ford Motor folks I worked with were all up there cheering. It was great.
Oh, I would imagine it's great. And tell me about the museum. Worth a visit, I would think.
The museum is where it had all happened, and people are amazed because they look inside, and to them it looks small. The inside of the museum was Acoustivoice. It's designed for recording by the different surfaces, the soft and reflective surfaces for sound. And I had the opportunity when they first opened that museum, and it had been shut for 25 years, and I went over there with the curator of the Henry Ford Museum and the curator back then of Motown Museum, and they opened that door, and I walked inside there, and it was spooky. I could feel something in there, you know, like real, I don't know what it was, but there was something in there, and it was just like that place had been locked for 25 years, and that's the first time they opened that up, and I was in there.
Oh, my Dennis. So, well, I've had the best of times here. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, so did I. Dennis Coffey, his book is Guitars, Bars, and Motown Superstars. You can also find him playing that Scorpio song on our Facebook page if you want to rock out a little bit more. It's The Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook. And we thank Rhonda Fanning and Chrissy Pease for putting a lot of work into producing this show. It was kind of fun, wasn't it? Yeah, it was. With you again on Monday for All Things Political. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.